Why does it often take the worst times to bring out the best in people? I'm not sure why that is, except that light tends to shine the brightest in the darkest situations. It may be that the best in people has always been there, but it's only when times are bad that it shines the brightest. Last Sunday, we began a study in the life of Caleb, borrowing from the title of President John F. Kennedy's book, Profiles in Courage. In this book, Kennedy wrote, "Great crises produce great men and great deeds of courage." I would suggest that great crises reveal great men more than produce them, but the thrust of the statement still holds true. It certainly did in the life of Caleb, which we're going to see this morning. Remember from last week's message that Caleb was one of 12 men chosen by Moses to enter the land of Canaan and bring back a report. We read earlier from Numbers chapter 13 about the mission. Moses told them, go in. They are encamped on the southern border of Canaan, the promised land. Go up through the desert, the Negev. Check out the coastlines, check out the hill country, go as far north as the Sea of Galilee, which they in fact did. They covered the entire land of what we know of as Israel. They had 40 days to go through and look to see what the land was like. Was it everything they had been told? You know, they had been told it was a land of milk and honey. A land that was very prosperous and plentiful. And remember where they're at. They're not in the middle of the Great Plains where everywhere you look something can grow. They were sitting in a desert, in a very arid kind of an environment. So to find fertile ground was really something back then. And so they were to look to see, but they were also to check out, what about the people who live there? What are they like? What are their cities like? Just go out and see what is happening there in Canaan. Bring back a report to us. And that is exactly what they did. They went out. They traveled over the entire land from south to north, from west to east. They went through the land. They took notes. They brought back some samples even. And they came back with a report to the people. And when you look in Numbers chapter 13, look down to verse 26. We hear the report that comes back from the tribes, from the spies. Beginning in verse 26, they came back to Moses and Aaron, and the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the desert of Paran. There they reported to them and the whole assembly and showed them the fruit of the land. They gave Moses this account. We went into the land which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit. Now the passage before this tells us, they took a single cluster of grapes, and it took two men to carry it on a pole between their shoulders. We're talking huge amount of grapes. The land was very prosperous. They had never seen anything like it. But, in some of your translations it might be, nevertheless, you see a change in the attitude of this report. The people who live there are powerful. The cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there. Now that doesn't mean anything to us, but insert the word giants here. And we will learn later on that Goliath, the giant whom David slew, came from these people. So when they said there were giants in the land, I've heard some preachers say, oh, they were just exaggerating. No, they were telling the truth. There really were a race of giants that lived back then. Now that doesn't mean that everybody in the land were giants. They were few and far between, but they were there. And they tended to be the fierce warriors and the most difficult to defeat. The Amalekites live in the Negev, which was the desert. The Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites live in the hill country. If you know anything about military strategy, it's always harder to attack uphill. The Canaanites live near the sea and along the Jordan. So there's enemies everywhere. And they saw that the militarily, this expedition was going to be difficult. At this point, we're going to see a break in the report. Up to this point, all 12 spies agree. They agree that the land is very plentiful. It's good land. The soil is fertile. You can grow crops there. This is everything we were told it would be. They also, all 12, agree that the cities are fortified. There are a lot of enemies. There are some giants in the land. This is going to be a formidable task. They all agree up to this point. But at this point, you're going to see a division. And just like in our Supreme Court, you have a majority and a minority report, that's exactly what we have here. Now, I want to focus first on the majority report. The men who had gone up with him said, "We can't attack these people. They are stronger than we are." And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. They said, "The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there, the descendants of Anak come from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them." See how quickly it turned from being a positive report, yes, the land is good, the land is plentiful, to, "We can't do this. It can't be done." It turned on that word, "nevertheless," or in some translations, "but." The whole tenor changes. And usually when you see that word in the Bible, it's a sign of unbelief. The people were strong. The cities were walled fortresses. There were giants in the land. And this was what dominated the majority report. Warren Wiersbe writes, "They saw the giants and they saw themselves as grasshoppers, but they did not see God. Their eyes were on the obstacles, not on the God who had led them there. Instead of reporting the blessings of the land, the 10 spies emphasized the difficulties, giving an evil report of God's holy land. Fear always sees the obstacles. Faith always sees the opportunities." And this majority report is dominated by fear. I like the way Stuart Briscoe puts it. Caleb and Joshua had grapes and the rest had gripes. It's very true. Now notice, when the spies saw themselves as grasshoppers, it was then they assumed that the Canaanites thought of them that way as well. "We were grasshoppers in our own eyes, and they looked at us that way too." But that wasn't true. You're going to find out later, when they actually did get into the promised land, the Canaanites were scared to death of these people. They had heard how they brought Egypt to its knees, and Egypt was the most powerful empire at that time. How this small group of people have a God so strong that it humbled all of the Egyptian gods, and when they left Egypt and the Egyptian army came after them, these people's God closed in the Red Sea on them. Those reports had gotten to the Canaanites and they were scared. They were scared to death. But see, what the majority, the 10 spies did, was they took their own inferiority complex and transferred it to the other people. They feel the same way we do. When in fact, they didn't. But this grasshopper complex is one of the most crippling of all attitudes that we can have. Because when we see ourselves as grasshoppers, or when we see ourselves as nothing, then not even the most obvious facts make the slightest bit of difference. We've already thrown in the towel. We've already said we can't do this. Perhaps the greatest single sin of Christians is the same mistake that's made by these spies. And that's facing human problems with human resources. Whether it's preparing a church budget, or sharing our faith, or tackling a personal problem, the question is often, how much can I do? Seldom do we ask, how much can God do? And when that happens, perpetual failure is inevitable. Instead of comparing our problems with God, we compare them with ourselves. Little wonder we soon feel like grasshoppers or pygmies against an army of giants. Do we consciously include God in all of our plans? Do we face the future with optimism, knowing that nothing is too hard for the Lord? Or is our lives characterized by human abilities, human responses, and human resources? You see, only those who learn to expose each new situation to the living God are delivered from the curse of this grasshopper complex. Now, fortunately, that concept was not unanimous among the 12 spies. There were two that had a different story. Their names are Joshua and Caleb. And their minority report constitutes the faithful response. You see, after the 10 had stirred up all the people with their pessimism, verse 30 says, "Then Caleb silenced the people and said, 'We should go up and take possession of the land because we can do this.'" Drop down into chapter 14. Verses 6 through 9 continues their response. "Joshua and Caleb, who were among those who had explored the land, tore their clothes and said to the entire Israelite assembly, 'The land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, He will lead us into the land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord. And do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will swallow them up. Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them.'" Now, if you take these two, the majority report of the 10 and the minority report of the 2, you might wonder if they were on the same mission. Were you even together? Were you looking at the same land? Were you looking at, did you see the same things? And I'm convinced that they did, to a point. I don't believe that Joshua and Caleb walked all through the promised land with their eyes closed saying, "I don't see any giants, do you?" What fortresses? No, they saw them. They were there. They knew the reality. They didn't have an inordinate view concerning themselves. They would have probably agreed, "Yeah, we're a bunch of grasshoppers, but we're God's grasshoppers. And with God, anything is possible." You see, they saw God. If you were to compare side by side the majority report of the 10 and the minority report of the 2, you know what the biggest difference is? In the majority report, they talk all about the land, the giants, the fortresses. Not one time do the 10 spies ever mention God. Not once. You read the words of Joshua and Caleb, and over you see God named. The Lord will give us the land. Don't rebel against the Lord. The Lord will do this. They saw God. In fact, there's a great expression here that we might miss. In Numbers 14:9, it literally says, "Do not fear the people of the land, for our bread they are." You think, that sounds... what does that mean? Think of it this way. We have a phrase that we use. It's a piece of cake, right? It's easy. No problem. That's exactly what they use the word bread instead. It's a piece of bread. We can do this. God has given us the land. Let's go. Caleb and Joshua are insisting, don't listen to these guys about the giants. We have a giant God. And He will take us into the land. And it's at this point that Caleb and Joshua exhibit the very essence of faith. You say, what is faith? Well, the Bible defines faith in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. I'd like to read it out of the New Living Translation. Faith is the confidence that what we hope for will actually happen. It gives us assurance about things we cannot see. Did you notice those two words, confidence, assurance? I mean, that marks Caleb and Joshua here. They're confident. They're certain. We can go. We can do this. But notice that their confidence and their assurance is not in themselves. They're not conceited. They're not arrogant. It's in God. Last week I had mentioned a passage from 2 Corinthians 3. I think it's fitting here as well. 2 Corinthians 3, verses 4 and 5. "Such confidence as this is ours through Christ before God. Not that we are competent in ourselves to claim anything for ourselves, but our confidence comes from God." See, they didn't think they could go in their own power and do it, but with God's strength they could do anything. Fear saw the obstacles. Faith saw the opportunities. Fear focuses on the outward circumstances. Fear focuses on an omnipotent Creator. Fear says it can't be done. Faith says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And when life's challenges arise in our lives, how are we going to face them? With fear or with faith? Now, our story doesn't end here. Upon hearing both sides, the people of Israel accepted the majority report and rejected the minority report of Caleb and Joshua. Here they made a decision that determined their destiny. Numbers 14, verses 1 through 4 records their furious reaction. "That night, all the people of the community raised their voices and wept aloud. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole community said to them, 'If only we had died in Egypt or in this desert. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt?' And then they said to each other, 'Let's choose a leader and go back to Egypt.'" Unbelievable. The land of slavery, they'd been there for 400 years. Brutally treated. Oh, let's go back there. We'd rather do that than have faith in God. Now, you might think the people would hail Caleb and Joshua for their faith, but they had a different idea. Verse 10 says, "Let's stone him to death." Here they stood up for the right thing. They had faith. And the majority said, "Oh, let's get rid of these people. We don't want to hear that." They wanted to silence them. Now, how could the people come to this fateful conclusion? They simply followed the majority. I mean, this is probably the most American story you have in all the Bible. The majority rules. Right? That's what democracy is all about. The majority is always right. Yeah, maybe not. Here the majority was dead wrong. In fact, this kind of majority attitude reminds me of a quote by Arnold Toynbee that goes something like this: it is doubtful if the majority is ever right. Think about it. If we believe in fallen human nature, that we are in essence sinful and separated from God, we're lucky if the majority is ever right. But we have been fooled into thinking that we've got to go with the crowd. We've got to go along with what everybody else is saying and doing and thinking. Joshua and Caleb had to stand alone. So those who don't have vision or determination, those who refuse to dream the impossible, they're almost always in the majority. And they're always the ones that want to take a vote. Well, let's vote on it. They'll always outshout and outnumber those who walk by faith, not by sight. Those who are seeking the kingdom of God and His righteousness. Those who choose to live by sight will always outnumber those who choose to live by faith. 10 spies saw the problem. 2 saw the solution. 10 saw the obstacles. 2 saw the answers. 10 were impressed by the size of the enemies. 2 were impressed by the size of their God. 2 focused on what could not be accomplished. 10 focused on what could not be accomplished. 2 focused on what could easily be accomplished by the power of God. And this persistence demonstrated by Caleb and Joshua is nothing short of remarkable. They weren't more intelligent than the other men. They weren't more talented. They simply possessed a bulldog determination based on their faith in God. And they would not let it go. Andrew Jackson once said, "One man with courage makes a majority." I've heard others say, "God plus one makes a majority." If you have God on your side, it doesn't matter how many people are opposed to you. To be the only one to stand on the side of God takes courage, especially in the face of a furious reaction like you see here against Caleb and Joshua. Kennedy wrote in Profiles in Courage, "It takes great courage to do what you think is right, even if it means the end of your career and the dislike and criticism of your friends and your neighbors." It takes guts. Takes courage. That's something that Caleb had. Now, for his part, God had had enough. If you read on in Numbers 14 down to verses 10 through 12, "Then the glory of the Lord appeared at the tent of meeting to all the Israelites. The Lord said to Moses, 'How long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe in me in spite of all the miraculous signs I have performed among them? I will strike them down with a plague and destroy them, but I will make you into a nation greater and stronger than they.'" God had had enough. He was ready to wipe them off the face of the earth, but Moses prayed on their behalf. He asked God to spare them, not because they deserved it, but for His own glory. Moses says, in effect, "After all, God, it'd look pretty bad on you if you brought them out of Egypt and wiped them out here. Wouldn't look good on your resume." And God granted Moses' request. Verses 20 through 24, "The Lord replied, 'I have forgiven them, as you have asked. Nevertheless, as surely as I live, and as surely as the glory of the Lord fills the whole earth, not one of the men who saw my glory and the miraculous signs I performed in Egypt and in the desert, but who disobeyed me and tested me 10 times, not one of them will ever see the land I promised on oath to their forefathers. No one who has treated me with contempt will ever see it. But because my servant Caleb has a different spirit and follows me wholeheartedly, I will bring him into the land, and his descendants will inherit it." You see, the Israelites had rejected the land to which God had brought them, and their punishment was they would not enter it. They said, "We can't go in, So the Lord said, you won't go in, except for Caleb and Joshua. God makes special mention of Caleb, promising that he will live to see the promised land. He will go in and inherit it. And his descendants will live there as well. Caleb said, we can go in. And the Lord said to him, you will go in. According to his faith, it was done unto him. So how do we apply this message to our lives today? I think the lesson is quite clear. The majority is not always right. In fact, it is often wrong. The men God has used down through history have always stood against the flow. Martin Luther, William Carey, William Wilberforce, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. How we need to remember this. Because ours is a day where truth is discerned, is determined by consensus. Justice is struck by a 5-4 vote. And everybody is doing it becomes the pervasive rationale for our behavior. Thomas Jefferson once feared the tyranny of the majority. It's a reality. It's all around us. Spiritual leaders do not necessarily go along with the majority opinion. It takes courage to stand up for what's right when it seems that nobody else is. Don't get swept into the current of public opinion or popular thinking. The crowds usually run on fear. We are called to live by faith. And it's only then will we experience what God has promised, just like Caleb did. Our invitation hymn this morning, it's hymn number 351. Think if this hymn had been around back then, Caleb would have led the congregation in singing it. Rise up, O men of God! Have done with lesser things. Give heart, mind, soul, and strength to serve the King of Kings. Don't let the fears and the doubts dissuade you. Don't let popular opinion get you off the track. Rise up. If need be, stand alone. Because when you stand with God, you truly are not alone. In fact, you're not even outnumbered. When you stand with God, you are victorious.